This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I'm interviewing an author named P.W. Catanese. He's the author most recently of a book called The Books of Umber, Happenstance Found. How are you, Paul?
I am very well, thank you.
I noticed that you write under the name of P.W. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because my preference would have been to just go with my first name, Paul. But as it turned out, there is another Paul Catanese out there. And not only does he write books, even though they're nonfiction books about, I think about like software design or something along those lines, and he's an experimental artist as well. And the guy had also snagged the URL paulcatanese.com. Right before I tried to. So if I couldn't have my author name as a website, I knew I'd have to do something different because I think that's important these days. So I went with my initials.
So how long have you been writing?
I started writing The Thief and the Beanstalk probably about 15 years ago, and that was an ordeal getting that published. It was probably an eight-year process.
Really? 8 years?
Of going from just getting the germ of the idea to actually getting – it was amazing. My agent had the book for 2 years before he read the manuscript and called me back and said he wanted to represent me. And then my eventual publisher, Simon & Schuster, had the manuscript for 2 years before they called my agent and said, hey, we kind of like this book.
That's amazing. Yeah. I guess that's not a totally unusual story, so that anyone who is aspiring to be a writer can take that as an example of how things work.
Yes, brace yourself. That would be my advice.
Well, what prompted you to become a writer of books? And I don't want to say you're a children's author, but you write books for young adults.
I do. And I can actually, I don't know how many authors can do this, but I can really pinpoint the moment. And
yeah.
What was happening was that I was reading fairy tales to my daughter at night. And she had asked to read the Jack and the Beanstalk fairy tale over and over again. So that story kind of got stuck in my head. And then so I was thinking about it as I was driving to work one morning, and I was thinking about, you know, it would actually be kind of interesting to write a scene from a more kind of adult point of view, and do the things that fairy tales don't do, where you just go into a lot of description. And I had this image in my head for how I would write the scene where the beanstalk grows, and really just for fun, I went home that night after work. And I started to write it. And I think back sometimes and I wonder, you know, what if I'd gotten distracted that day, or what if I'd gotten home and I was too tired and I didn't follow that creative impulse that I had? I wouldn't have done all the things that I've done today. You know, now I've got, you know, my seventh book will be out in January, and I've got about 500,000 books in print. And it all wouldn't have happened if I hadn't just followed that creative impulse.
That's an important point. You actually did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think a lot of people would look back on their lives and mm-hmm. say, I wrote down that idea for a book and I never did it.
Right, right. So I think the lesson there is that when something strikes you like that, you got to follow up on it, and just at least a little bit to see where it goes, because, you know, it might have gone nowhere, but I immediately felt like I was doing something that had possibilities.
And how long did it then take you to write that particular story?
I spent a couple of years on that, and because part of it was I had never even tackled a book before, and then when I decided that, you know, hey, this isn't a short story, this is actually a long story, it may even be a novel, and then I said, okay, I'm going to try to turn this into a novel. I did a lot of research, so I actually put the book aside for a while just to read books about writing books, and I spent a lot of time rewriting that book. I spent as much time probably rewriting it as I would spend on two books.
So, but you did this all by yourself. You had no. It wasn't like you had a teacher or
no,
a guru.
No, I didn't. I didn't have a teacher. I never joined a writer's group. You know, and not that there's nothing wrong with writer's group, but I just kind of did it on my own. I showed it to a couple of people that I thought might have, you know, good instincts and could have helped me out, but really just sort of following my own gut for the most part.
Did you test the story on your children?
I let them read it as I was writing it, you always usually get good feedback from your family,
right.
but I shared it with some other people too, and encouraged them to be critical. And it's actually very hard for friends to be critical.
Yeah, I would think it's hard for family,
mm-hmm.
anybody close to you, to have that kind of critical eye. Yeah. And also it's difficult, even if they feel that something's wrong, how do they tell you? You know, right. They don't know how to do that. It's not part of the conversation.
Yes, editors at publishing houses do not have that problem.
Right, but that's why that you have an editor. That's
exactly
it's a good,
right. Yes.
Well, so after you did that book, you did subsequently you written a number of what I guess would be characterized as fairy tales rewritten or reconceived.
Well, fairy tale sequels is probably the quickest way to put it, because what I did with The Thief and the Beanstalk. Was I knew I didn't want to retell the Jack and the Beanstalk story. That wasn't interesting or fresh to me. So my idea was, I'll write a sequel to that. So I will tell about what happens 60 years after the Jack and the Beanstalk story, and I'll use the sort of the loose threads of the original tale to weave a new adventure, and at the same time, you know, kind of within the book, also sort of reimagine what happened earlier. And so when I wrote that book my agent and I approached publishers with it, what we said was, hey, you know, we can do this for other fairy tales. And so I gave them treatments for several other ideas, other sequels to other fairy tales. And then that became the basis for my first five books.
Right. And so after those first five, and would you say those are written for kids maybe 8 to 12? Is that the right
range? Yeah, I think, you know, I always say like 9 and up. Because
certainly adults can read it.
I don't want to discourage an adult from reading it, and I have a large number of adult readers, and it's really gratifying, because honestly, when I write it, I don't think of myself as writing it for children. I think of myself as writing it for everyone, but the subject matter obviously appeals to kids.
Yeah, no, and I read one of the Riddle of the Gnome, mm-hmm. And I would say as an adult reader. Who, you know, I read a lot of things, obviously, but when my kids were younger, I read a lot of children's books aloud. Mm-hmm. I felt that this was very readable for any age. I agree with you there.
Yeah.
I think you've succeeded in that. And of course, moving on, the book that got me to you in the first place, which is The Books of Umber, I felt is readable by any age.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a very
totally
serious
agree,
way.
Yeah. It is.
You know, there are things in it that I can tell would appeal to a kid. But you don't have to feel like as a reader you're reading down
right.
in any way.
Right.
This is a pretty impressive book. I've read a lot of science fiction, a lot of fantasy, and I love some of it. Visually, you visualize beautifully. You know the world that this book takes place in. I thought that was really great. You know the alternate world sometimes is. You know, the richness of the detail is what makes it work, I think.
Right.
And but also your imagination. You know, you did some great stuff with the, I can't remember the name of the woman, but it's that the boat.
Oh, yes.
The ship.
Nima.
She's great.
The Leviathan barge.
There's some terrific kind of attributes mm-hmm. in the story. And, of course, it's complicated, too, because you have a character who is from another universe, planet,
right.
dimension, which is potentially ours, and so mm-hmm. you have a message, I think, in this book that's pretty profound.
Yes, and you try not to be too heavy-handed with your messages, but it's kind of backdrop, but I think it lends the book maybe just a little more weight because it has that theme going for it.
Right. Now, but this one is different from the series. I don't want to call it, well, I may be mischaracterizing it as a series, but this is different from the fairy tale sequels.
Right.
Because this is a book that has no reference to another story.
That's right. That's right. And the first five books that I did were collectively known as Further Tales. And they're actually, each of them is a standalone title, so you don't have to read them in any order.
Right.
They're not really connected. But however, in my head, those books all sort of took place sort of in the same world. So when I was writing those, I kind of had created this sort of fantasy universe. And even when I was writing the second book, which is called The Brave Apprentice, I had a scene where the premise of the Brave Apprentice is there's this invasion of trolls, and I wrote the scene where the king calls a meeting with all of his advisors and wise people from all over the place, and they're discussing what are we going to do about these trolls and what can we learn about trolls, and this old advisor comes in and he mentions this guy named Umber, who is a historian and kind of an adventurer, and he's written about trolls. So this guy talks about this guy Umber, who has written about trolls.
And you now, just made this guy up.
I just pulled the name out of thin air, and as I was writing it, but as soon as I wrote it down, I thought, well, gee, that would be an interesting premise for a book unto itself, which is a guy who is he's sort of like a paranormal investigator in the world of fairy tales. So I started thinking about this guy named Umber. And then I actually mentioned him again in my third book, The Eye of the Warlock. Again, Umber is referenced as this guy who's sort of he's sort of an authority on monsters and stuff and magical things. And that was back in probably like 2003 when I was writing that stuff. So 6 years later, when I had finished the fifth of my fairy tale inspired books, I had the idea for my next series, and so the Books of Umber series is more or less built on the previous books, and yet you don't have to have read the first five books at all. But if you have read the first five books and you read this, you'll actually notice kind of interesting connections going back. Or if you, having read the Books of Umber, were to dive back into the other titles, you may notice, you know, place names, and I may even pull a creature or two into a future adventure.
Does this mean, in some kind of imaginary way, the universe of the first books is connected?
Yeah, exactly.
The universe.
Well, I had my geography. Right. And the place was so rich and real, and I had drawn a map for myself, my own reference, and something that I'll give to readers when I go visit schools, that kind of shows where all the various adventures take place,
and that's good.
And then so it was kind of easier to sort of begin there, and then kind of just create a whole new thing for this Umber to dwell in, and also basically he was born out of that universe, so it made sense for him to live there.
But in terms of time. Does this new book, The Happenstance Found, mm-hmm. how does it connect in the universe?
The timeline, I would say that it's probably almost contemporary, for example, with The Thief and the Beanstalk. But it's funny because I kind of, in my head, I have this. I haven't written it down. It's not official. But The Mirror's Tale was maybe like 20 years before. The Thief and the Beanstalk is kind of contemporary, so that like Umber may be sort of aware of those events that are going on in this distant land, and he's probably very curious about it.
So let's talk a little bit about the Books of Umber. I think the opening is pretty incredible. You know, you've got this, it's sort of like I imagine it as almost you've got the beginning of the book is literally a blank slate.
Yes.
Because
mm-hmm.
the character is waking up,
mm-hmm.
Happenstance is
right.
a character in the book. He doesn't have an identity.
Right, exactly.
He doesn't know who he is.
Yes.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about what happens to Happenstance in the book. But because his life unfolds, his life is being created as the story
almost
goes on.
Page by page, yeah. And there's an allusion to that too, because and it literally is you're and that's what the author does. You create a character out of nothing, basically,
exactly.
And that's literally how this boy's life unfolds. He wakes up with he has an intellect. He actually has a very powerful intellect, and he has all these strange abilities. But he has no past, so his identity is sort of formed over the course of the pages of the book.
But he's going to be a very important character because of his powers, and there's this sense, not even sense. I mean, you suggest that there's something going on that he's part of.
Yes.
And he has to find out what that is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it really, as it turns out, both of the main characters are sort of mysteries. And each of them has a surprising origin. And of course, in Happenstance's case, I don't reveal all of that in the first book.
Right, we have no idea. Right,
yeah.
As the book closes, we really actually don't know everything that about Happenstance.
Right, you know more about Umber than you do
you know a lot about Umber.
And Umber's very surprising background. And
yeah, you give
it, yeah.
And I'm not going to give it away for the
Thank
because
you.
I think it's important for people to be able to experience the surprise. This is a book with a surprise ending. And it's important for any reader to not jump to the back of the book,
right.
as some people do,
mm-hmm.
to see what's going to happen. That would really spoil it.
Yeah.
But it is a surprise ending. It does kind of create the overall structure for the rest of the series, I think.
Yeah, and that's the challenge of writing the first book in a series, is that you have to make the book good at the same time that the book is setting the stage for the books to come. And that's it's actually a delicate balancing act, because you know, you're sort of like, it's kind of like setting up the chessboard, but you have to make that to make that fun, and you have to make
that exciting.
Well,
and also for the reader, it has to be satisfying on its own.
Yes,
that it's you know, it's a book.
Mm-hmm.
It has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
You don't have to read the next book to be satisfied.
But
with
hopefully
the first
you want
one.
To.
Well,
yeah.
Of course. No, we want you. Everyone. I mean, any writer would want that. But I, as a reader, I can be satisfied with this book,
mm-hmm.
And hopefully, I will go on to the next. But you've said that there are seven. I think we've only talked about six. What's the other book?
That's the next one.
Oh, the
that's,
next
that's
one.
The
okay.
Next one in the
which
the
is
books
called
of
what?
That will be called Dragon Games.
So all of them will be Books of Umber as the header, and then
that's right.
The subtitle or or individual book title.
That's right.
And when is that book coming?
That
out?
Will be out. That will be out in January. This coming January 2010, and then the paperback of Happenstance Found will come out a month before that.
And so that means you've completed the next book.
Dragon Games, actually, I'm at home. I have the copy-edited manuscript, which just came in this week, so I'm kind of going through that page by page. It's one of the more tedious parts of of being an author.
Right, it's a part that probably most writers enjoy the least, because it puts you back into the book.
Yeah.
You have to look at almost every word,
mm-hmm.
and make sure, because the copy editor is going to find things that are either inconsistent or might be grammatically wrong, but you might have done them on purpose. You have to make sure that they don't change the meaning of your book.
That's right. That's right. So you do. You have to watch that very carefully. But for the most part, thank goodness for them, because they do catch those one or two little things that you would hate to slip into print.
Right. I think it's something that many people are not even aware of, that in the process of producing a book, you have not just the editor,
right,
but you have these other people who make sure that the book is actually correct.
Yeah, exactly. And they're kind of anonymous, the copy editors.
Yeah, but they're important. Happenstance Found has been out for several months.
Yes.
Do you go out on the road and visit schools and talk to people about the book?
Yeah, I do. I do. As a matter of fact, I was at a school yesterday in Bristol, Connecticut. It's a wonderful school that I've been going to now. I think this was the fifth year in a row. And it was that started the way a lot of my school visits start, where a teacher discovers the book and then reads the book aloud to class.
And the books, what age? What age?
These were fifth graders. And that's a great, they're a lot of fun to go talk to. But I was out in Nevada a couple months ago. I've been to Michigan this year. I was in Florida. And then in addition to several places in Connecticut, I was in Maryland. So it's picked up, and it's fun to go out, and especially other parts of the country. And
I think it's great, being with kids when
they're wonderful. Yeah. And then also, when you're a writer, you're a hermit and you're working in solitude. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you're an actor where you finish your performance and then you get to hear people applaud or boo. Yeah, you don't know how they react until you get an email from them, or you go and you talk to students.
So, and I should mention that, just to locate us, we're in Connecticut. This is where you're from.
That's right.
More or less grew up here, went to the University of Connecticut.
That's right.
I guess the other question I was going to ask you or talk about is just you're almost a full-time writer, but you have a day job.
That's right.
And balance, I'm just curious about the balance of, and the fact is that you're a writer by trade.
Yes.
Working in an advertising agency, so you use your writing skills on a day-to-day basis.
I do. And then I go home and I write some more.
Right.
And it's almost like, to me, it's like different muscles, because, in my day job, it's really a lot about collaboration and brainstorming. You work in teams when you work for an advertising agency, and there's a lot of people, providing input into what you do, within your company, and then from the clients
the
as
clients
well.
Too.
So
yeah.
It's really about, it's about this little coalition, and trying to get something finished, with a lot of people in the kitchen. And what's nice about the novel writing is you go home and it's just you. And you're just following your own following your own instincts. So,
but do you ever feel? I guess I would ask: is there a tension between the day job? Sometimes do you feel, oh my God, if I had more time, I could write more novels.
Yeah, the most important thing is that my publisher, Simon & Schuster, really gives me enough time, to write it. Knowing that I have a full-time job, and I don't have all the time in the world, to work on it. So, you know, I have close to a year, you know, to write one of these things. And I think if I was a full-time writer, I could probably pull a book off in probably 2 months, you know, if I put the same sort of hours that I put into my day job. You know, I just work, I give myself a quota of about 800 words, in a night. And they're usually pretty good words. And I've done a little bit of rewriting as I go, and I don't always hit that. And then sometimes I exceed it. And I know if I just, you know, if I keep doing those 800 words every night, I'm going to have, you know, a rough draft in about, you know, 4 or 5 months. And then I have a couple months to polish it up.
So your process is write every day, more or less.
Yep.
And then rewrite at the, finish the book.
Yeah.
Rough.
Mm-hmm.
And then go back and rewrite.
Yeah.
Not polish as you
exactly.
go.
Yeah. And you add a little bit here and you hack away a lot over there.
Right. Do you have anybody you test your? I mean, do you like read aloud to your kids? Well, how, your kids are probably too old now.
Yeah, they're older now. Yeah, I've got I've got one just graduated from college, and I've got another one in college, and I've got a high school student. But my high schooler is actually a very good reader for me, and he has a very keen eye, and he's very good at
probably knows you pretty well by now.
Yeah, and he does. Yes, and he knows the whole series pretty well too. So he's a good continuity guy.
So
my wife is actually a writer and an editor, she also has a fantastic editing eye. So I'm lucky to have.
Oh, that helps
somebody.
A lot. Actually,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Although you know, obviously, one can imagine in a marriage, the two people being writers can be tricky too.
Yeah. Well, she's it's very simple. She writes. She's like a medical writer, and so she's all about facts and stuff, and I'm all about fiction. So,
oh,
so it's not really, we don't really overlap much.
Yeah, so that's a good balance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And so, in the Books of Umber series, how many will there be, or is this an open question?
No, there will be three. There will be three books. I actually initially thought there might be more. And then my publisher says, you know, we'd really rather have it be three. So I kind of went back to work and thought about the whole arc of the story. And it ended up, I think, being a really good thing because everything is very condensed and there's like so much happening. I mean, a lot happens in book one.
It's a very active
book. Book two, so much more happens. It's bigger and it has the advantage, of course, of you know the cast already. So I don't have to spend time introducing people.
Right.
They're already there. They're fully formed. You know, Umber is still Umber and Happenstance is still Happenstance and Oates is still Oates. And so you can just sort of launch right into the adventure. So just like the second book is absolutely wild. There's it's really jam packed with stuff and some of the craziest things that I've ever written about.
Well,
I
will look forward to reading it, and hopefully I assume everyone else will as well. I want to thank you, Paul P.W. Catanese, author of Books of Umber, Happenstance Found, among other books, The Mirror's Tale, The Brave Apprentice, The Eye of the Warlock, and The Riddle of the Monome. There's one more, The Thief and the Beanstalk.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gotten them all in there.
Right.
I do recommend people go to your website, which is pwcatanese.com.
That's right.
And thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, David.
And this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host.